Can you hear me all right? My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, delighted to be here in beautiful southwestern Florida. I came down yesterday, and Jimmy arranged for somebody to take me out and thoroughly thrash me on a golf course today, so I feel real good about myself. But I really had a good time since I've been down here. Some of what we're going to try to do in the next couple of days is talk about the steps. I was talking to a gentleman earlier, and he said that his particular section of Florida, they don't talk a lot about the steps, and I found that to be true around the country, from place to place. And I don't understand why, because I find the steps to be a thoroughly fascinating endeavor, not only to work them, but to discuss them. I'd like to say, I do this from time to time in different places, and one of the things I'd sort of like to say is sort of a cautionary note. It's really easy on a weekend to get into the book and to get all fired up about doing the steps and that sort of thing, and then to go home and to not do much with it. I would hate it if something like this took the pressure off sufficiently to not have to work the steps, because I'm one of those people who believe I believe what the book says, and the book says, for example, if we don't take a fourth step, we'll surely drink again, and I think that's true. I've been sober since May the 13th, 1973, so I've got a little over 24 years and 4 months of sobriety. I know it's hard to believe someone as young as I am could be sober that long, but trust me, I never expected to stay this long either. And I'm not a person who leaped into these steps. Quite the contrary. I looked for every way possible to not do them, including being very actively involved in 12-step work and going to prisons and to psychiatric hospitals and all the rest of it. And then I got very interested in becoming successful. That's one of the great diseases for those of us who try to avoid the steps. I worked hard. I went to school. I got a couple more degrees. I started organizations. I did all this stuff. And none of that works like the steps. It's a lot easier to not work and work the steps, and it's a lot easier on the nervous system. So I'm a guy who came to Alcoholics Anonymous and did not leap into these steps. And I tried everything else. I tried relationships. Anybody here ever tried relationships instead of the steps? They work for a weekend, but there's not much serenity involved in all of that. I tried a variety of things instead of doing the steps, and often wondered why that was. And I think it's largely because this whole concept of change is a frightening one for someone like me. I am not a guy who ever volunteered for change. I never thought I'd like it, and it isn't until after I do it that I look back and realize what a good thing it was. I was sober about 3.5 years. I had everything I said I'd need to be happy, and I was miserable. I had the job I always wanted. I had the relationships I always wanted. I had the house with the little townhouse, brick townhouse, and all that stuff. Everything I said I wanted, I needed to be happy, and I was miserable. And I remember there was a man around Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a lot of meetings. Another thing you do to keep from working the steps is you can go to a lot of meetings, and it's sort of like letting the pressure off. I'd feel all uptight, and I'd go to a meeting, and then I'd feel better, and then the next day it would be back, and I'd go to another meeting, and then I'd feel better. And I stayed very, very active, and I think that's why I didn't drink, but it sure didn't help the insides, and I went to a man who I noticed talked a lot about the steps. His name's Sandy B. He now lives up your way, I guess. Yeah, lives in Tampa now, but he was in Washington D.C. at the time, and I went to him and asked him if he'd consider sponsoring me, and I never forget that first day. He told me, he said, "Get your running shoes and come over to my apartment. Meet me in front of my apartment tomorrow morning at 7:30, Saturday morning." And I thought, well, you know, I don't really have any running shoes. I smoke 4 packs of cigarettes a day, and you don't need running shoes if you smoke 4 packs of cigarettes a day. And but I wouldn't let him know that I didn't have running shoes. And so I went and bought a pair of running shoes. And Saturday morning at 7:30 or so, I'm in front of his apartment building, and we went for a run. And I said to him, why are we running? Isn't it normal to go have a cup of coffee and talk? And he said, no, he said, one thing I've noticed about you is you have a hard time getting to the point. And he said, I thought if we're running, you might get to the point. Well, you know, when you're smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day and you're running, you get to the point. So I said to him, Sandy, would you consider being my sponsor? And he said, I said, yeah, I'll consider it. He said, tell me, do you believe in God? And boy, what an obnoxious question to ask a guy, you know, who's running along with you. And I remember, we were at dinner tonight, and we were talking about knowledge. And I remember somewhere along the line, I'm not saying anybody said this to me, but somewhere along the line, I got the impression that if I didn't believe entirely in God, it meant I didn't believe. I don't know if anybody else ever got that. I thought it was a Roman Catholic thing, but I got friends who were Baptists who heard the same thing. So maybe we heard it from bartenders and not in church. But it was this idea that if you didn't believe for sure, it meant you didn't believe. And I wanted to be perfectly honest with Sandy because I knew that this relationship would be the difference between living and not living. And I just knew that. I knew that taking these steps was a difference between living and not living. I'd gotten to that point. And I said to him, I said, you know, Sandy, I'm not sure I do believe in God. And what I meant to say was I had doubts. But that isn't what I said. I said, I'm not sure I do believe in God. And he looked at me, he was very sad, and he said, that's too bad, Keith. That means you're probably going to die. And I stopped running. And he kept running. And I thought for a minute, and then I caught up with him, and I said, you know, I'm willing to go home and reconsider my position. And he said, you know, if you'll reconsider your position, I'll sponsor you. And so that's how this whole journey began for me. I reconsidered my position. And within the next year, I had done the first 9 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, of course, my life changed in a way that was profound and dramatic. What was dramatic about it was the fact that there was a lot less drama in it. I was one of those people who sort of lived a soap opera. I sponsor a lot of young people now, and I can't be around them too long. I go crazy because, you know, they're into all this drama, you know. I mean, it's just, and I just can't handle it anymore. I have to back off and get some sleep. But my life became much less dramatic, and it became much more peaceful. And for the first time probably in my life, I felt as though I belonged where I was. I was one of those people. I was one of those people who, if I'd have stayed in town, my thought was I should have gone out of town. And if I went out of town, my thought was I should have stayed in town. I was never where I thought I was supposed to be. I remember my sponsor said to me one time, he said, I was telling him about this, and he said, yeah, I know how you feel. He said, I could be standing on a corner in a strange city, and someone would come up to me and say, excuse me, you're standing in my spot, and I'd move. And I really understood that because I always felt as though I was standing in someone else's spot. Now, I know that happens when we're drinking. I'd be in bed with my wife, and I'd feel like a stranger. I'd feel like I was in bed with somebody else's wife. Or I could go down the hallway late at night, those nights when I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. And I go down the hallway, and I go into the kids' room. I have two beautiful daughters, and they were just little infants at the time, and I go in and rub their little heads, and I was convinced they couldn't be mine. I mean, that's how detached I was from life and from reality. And I understood that, drinking. But here I was sober, and I still didn't feel as though there was a place for me. I still felt as though I had to lie a little or cheat a little or do something just to belong. I had to exaggerate a little bit just to belong. And it wasn't until I worked the first 9 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in an organized and meaningful way that began to change for me, that I began to belong where I was. I began to deserve what I had. It's a dramatic change. And so one of my favorite things is sponsorship, and I love sponsoring guys and taking them through the steps. I do it in prisons. I do it in a lot of places, but because I don't know of anything else that has ever happened to me that has profoundly changed my life, prepared me for God's will like working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So in the next few days, what we'll do, with your permission, is just sort of drag ourselves through these 12 steps, these 12 propositions, as they're called. And we'll talk a little bit about my experience with them. I'm available to you the whole weekend. If you have any questions or anything, please feel free to, you know, to pull me aside and to nail me. And there are a lot of old-timers around here who probably know a lot more about these topics than I do. You know, you always hear people say, I don't speak for AA. You know, I love that. I always like to say, I do speak for AA, and if you don't believe me, call New York, and they'll tell you. But the truth is, I don't. I ought to speak for AA, but I don't. They haven't discovered me yet, but they will, of course. Probably right after I'm dead. That's the way it works in Alcoholics Anonymous. But pull me aside or grab somebody else. And again, what I'm going to share, I'm not going to read to you from the book. I know most of you can read, so I'm not going to do that. I'll refer to it from time to time. But what I'm really going to refer to, more than anything else, are my experiences or the experience of people that I've worked with and that sort of thing. I find that the steps are very much a living phenomenon, and they change for me. They change all the time. Once Sandy began to sponsor me, he gave me some pretty specific instructions. And one of the instructions he gave me was to read a step in the 12 and 12 every day. And I did that for many, many years. And he was he liked the big book, but he really loved the 12 and 12. And most of the work we did was in the 12 and 12. I go back, of course, and read and reread and reread, and I don't know whether it's because I have brain damage or what, but the thing keeps changing. It's really dramatic. Every 2 years on January the 1st, I get a new big book and a new 12 and 12, and I start over. And I mark them up and that sort of thing, and then I put them on a bookshelf every 2 years, and I get another big book and another 12 and 12, and I start over. It's like it's fresh. You get a new book. And the guys I sponsor come and steal the old ones to find out what I was thinking a few years ago, I guess. I mark them up pretty good, and then I stick them on a shelf and start all over. And if you've done these steps, this might be a good weekend to kind of start over, to take another look and do them again. There are people around our program like Clarence Snyder. Many of you knew Clarence. Who says that we take these steps one time. And everybody used to freak out when Clarence would say that. He'd say, what do you mean? What do you mean? I've taken 5-4 steps and on. And then he'd smile, and he'd say, but we take at them for years. And that's been my case. I've taken at these steps for years. I'm a person who has an open 8th step list. I still have a couple people on my 8th step list that I haven't been able to find. What my sponsor has instructed me to do is to find a substitute for those people. And I have. I found people like those people, and I've done things for them in order to satisfy that 9th step. But I keep it open. 2 weeks from now, I will be in Rochester, New York, and I've finally located a man who I owe an amends to from about 24 years ago. And I've had him on my list, and I've been praying for him. And I finally located them, so I'll be able to make another amends. But I'm a person who keeps my 8th step list open. I just keep it open. I keep it in my big book, and every morning when I pray for these people, and I pray for the ability to forgive them or anybody else in my life. So I think these steps are basically a living program. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the first step. You know, the first step is often called the most important of all the steps. And Bill says it's the only step that we take perfectly. And the depth of the first step is what amazes me. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought what the first step said was, I can't drink safely. And, of course, it says so much more than that. It says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. When it happened for me, when I got sober, I was given a gift. I think that when we get sober, we're all given something sort of special. And I was given a gift, and the gift was this, That morning, when I woke up, May the 13th, 1973, I was living in a Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. I lost my wife and my children and virtually everything that was of value. I was living in a basement of a house, and I went in the bathroom, or what passed as a bathroom in this place, to commit suicide. And I always thought that suicide would be a big deal. You know, I always thought suicide was a big deal. I never understood how anybody could take their own life. And now I understand. That day, suicide was just the next thing. I believe that alcoholism is a disease. It's, like the book says, it's progressive. And what I won't do this year, I'll do next year. And alcoholism is a disease that causes me to seek the relief that it used to offer me. I had my first drink in 1961, the day I joined the Marine Corps, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And, I was a 17-year-old kid who was scared of everything. I was born scared, and I never improved. And the older I got, the more I had to be scared of. I mean, that's the way it worked for me. And that night, I tell you exactly the day. It was July the 14th, 1961. After I was sworn into the Marine Corps, I went to a bar with three other guys who had joined. And for the first time in my life, I had an opportunity to drink as much as I wanted. And my life changed that night. And if you're alcoholic, you know what I mean. I mean, all those fears were gone. I knew nothing about anything. I knew nothing about life or about God or about women. I knew nothing about politics. And mostly, I didn't know anything about the Marine Corps. And I was a kid who thought you couldn't ask. So I go and join the Marine Corps not having any idea what the Marine Corps is about. The only thing I knew was they took a certain number of men down to the South Carolina swamps and drowned them. It's the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps. And here I go and join. But that night, somewhere between the second and third beer, my life changed. And if you're alcoholic, you know exactly what I mean. I mean, all that fear was gone. I was alive for the first time in my life. I understood things that I never understood before. I was one of these really confused kids. I had a speech impediment. I was a funny-looking little kid, and my ears stuck out. I looked like a cab with the back doors open. And all of a sudden, I was 6 feet 4 inches tall, and I was handsome. And I looked around that bar, and the women in that bar were looking at me with hungry eyes. I mean, it was an amazing thing what happened to me when I took three drinks. And I continued to drink the rest of the evening. I drank probably for 7 hours, and I somehow made it to the train that night. I was very, very drunk, and I went into a blackout, and I passed out on the floor of the Pullman coach. The next morning, I woke up, and someone had wet the floor I was lying on, and they had wet me, too. And I got up, and I changed my clothes. And any sane person, after an experience like that, the last thing in the world they would want to do is drink. But I was an alcoholic, and the first thing I wanted to do was drink, because all the fear was back, and all the questions were back, and everything. And I knew that the night before, I'd arrived at a solution for what was wrong with me. And the solution lies somewhere between the second and the third drink. And that, to me, is alcoholism. The next morning, I went over with everybody else, and I had beer for breakfast. And that night, I fell off a train in Yamasee, South Carolina. They'd sent a very rude man there to greet us when we got off the train. They called him a drill instructor. And he was hurling obscenities at me and the other young men who had gone down there to die for their country. And I remember I fell off the train. I missed a bottom step or something. I don't know exactly what happened, but I fell across the next set of railroad tracks. And this man was hurling obscenities at me. And I got up and I tried to explain to him that he'd probably do a lot better if he treated us with a little respect. And he never seemed to grasp what it was I was trying to get across to him. They say you can learn from every experience. And what I learned that night was you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned that night. And you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time, too. I learned that. But what I discovered more than anything else, and I never forgot it, was that alcohol changed the way life was. And that, to me, is alcoholism. And it got to the point where it didn't matter what it cost me. My one goal in life was to get back to Pittsburgh. The only time I ever felt whole and fully at peace was in Pittsburgh. And I spent whatever I had relationships, everything, to get back to Pittsburgh. And I sort of thought of it this way. I kind of thought that there is, it costs for the next drink. I remember what I wanted to do when I was in the service was to stay forever, and I worked very hard to get a commission, and I was offered a commission and everything, but because of my alcoholism, I lost it. And in the way I look back over the 12 years that I drank, it's something like this. I went to get a drink in an NCO club one day, and a bartender said to me, "That'll be 35 cents in your career," and I paid it. And then one day I went to get a bottle of gin or something, and the guy at the liquor store said, "That'll be $7 and your wife and your children," and I paid it. And then one day I went to buy some wine or something, and the guy said, "That'll be 79 cents in your life," and I was willing to pay it. So that's what alcoholism is to me. It means that I'll pay whatever it takes to get back to Pittsburgh. And I tried everything in the world to stop drinking. I was one of those people. I was one of those people who every morning quit. I don't know if you ever liked that. But every morning I'd quit. I'd pound on the steering wheel. And I'd say, "Tonight I'm not going to drink. Tonight I'm going to go home and I'm going to play with the kids and I'm going to take them to the playground and then I'm going to give them a bath and I'm going to read a story to them. And I'm going to chase my wife around the apartment. Tonight I'm not going to drink." And that afternoon, I'd be in Clyde's or Chadwick's or someplace, working on my second drink, wondering what I'd been so excited about that morning. And I did that every day. Every day I quit. Every afternoon I slipped. I wanted to stop drinking and I couldn't. I was completely powerless over alcohol. I'm going to share one more story about the powerless aspect, because I think if we don't understand this, it's impossible to understand the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm greatly concerned when people equate things like smoking cigarettes to alcoholism. Now, I quit smoking 20-some years ago. I don't recommend it to anybody. But there's a world of difference between quitting smoking and alcoholism. Smoking's a bad habit. Alcoholism's a disease. The difference between the two for me, it was a lot harder to quit smoking. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't easy. But I don't go to meetings to not smoke cigarettes. Matter of fact, when I go to meetings, I end up smoking cigarettes, everybody else's. But I don't go to meetings and not smoke cigarettes. But if I stop going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd drink again. And not I might, or I would if I'm not careful. I'd drink again. That's what having alcoholism is all about. And I know this is true, because I've seen it happen too many times. There are too many people, I 12-step, who've been sober 10, 12, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35 years. I 12-stepped a guy whose story's in the big book, who went back out. So I know that this is a disease. It's very, very different than a habit or an addiction. This is a disease. It's different. You know, when I was, I tried to think of this story that sort of signifies that for me was when I was... I was working with a fella who had every reason in the world to live. Every reason in the world to live. But he had an esophageal varice. We were talking about what that is and how that's critical and all the rest of it. And he said to me, he said, "You know, I don't want to die." And I said, "Then you'll have to not drink. The only way out for you is to not drink. For you to drink is to die." And he left me, and within 20 minutes he was drunk. And within 2 hours, he was dead. Now, he knew picking up that drink was going to kill him this time. There was no question about it. And yet, it couldn't stop him. And I understand that. When my second daughter was born, her name's Kimberly. When Kimberly was born, she had something called hyaline membrane disease. And, of course, she was about three months premature. She weighed a pound and a half or something. And I was passed out on the living room floor when it was time for her to be born. And I was watching a test pattern or something on TV, and my wife couldn't wake me up, so she invited neighbors over, and they're watching me lay on the floor in my underwear watching a test pattern. And finally, they threw water on me and everything, and they got me up, and I rushed her off to the hospital, and I worked in this hospital. And I was drunk, and I was demanding they take care of her, which is a joke. you know, I was drunk every night. I wasn't taking care of her, but I demanded that she was my wife and they take care of her and everything. And the baby was born, and Kimberly weighed, like I say, a pound and a half or 2 pounds. She was just a tiny little thing, and they gave her no chance of living. But 3 days before she was born, they brought an experimental machine into. I worked at Georgetown University Hospital, and they brought an experimental machine in, and they asked me if it would be all right if they put her on it. And they said, "We don't believe she'll live, and if she does live, we believe she'll probably be profoundly retarded because of the lack of oxygen. But would you object?" And her mother was in a state of shock and had a 1,000-yard stare, and I agreed to whatever they wanted to do. And it was a very critical time during this, and it's usually at around 72 hours. So at around 72 hours, I was sitting in my office in the dark with the door slightly ajar, watching through the crack in the door my little daughter try to live. The little thing would retract. She'd pick clear off the little mattress. She was laboring so hard at trying to get oxygen and terrified me. I was too afraid even to go near her. And I remember the night that they didn't think she'd live, and my wife went in and baptized her. And I couldn't even go to them. I wanted to, but I couldn't. And I remembered as a kid. When I was a kid, I was a pretty religious little kid and served Mass and did all that. And I remembered the tabernacle and what a special place it was. And that night I ran down to the chapel in the hospital and I got on my knees in front of the tabernacle and I begged God to let my little girl live. And I said, "If you'll let her live, I'll do anything, anything." And I said, "If you'll let her live, I'll stop drinking." And I was drunk in 12 hours. Now, I drank when I thought drinking would kill my baby. So I had absolutely no problems with the proposition that I was powerless over alcohol. I think it's only right to say that Blaise Pascal said one time, he said, "God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned the favor." And so I had created a God that would kill a little kid because her old man was sick. And I was wrong about that, thank God. She not only lived, she's an honors student, graduated from Auburn. I always kid her and tell her that I don't know what graduating from Auburn with honors really means, but she's now living. She's living up in a panhandle with her husband, who's a dentist, and a wonderful couple. And as a matter of fact, next month she's going to make me a grandfather for the first time. I know I don't look old enough, but I am. But I think what's important about that is that I meant with every fiber of my being to not drink, and I was drunk in 12 hours. You know, a couple of years later, I've taken to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a man standing at the door. They called him a greeter, an obnoxious guy, you know, look you in the eyes, you know the kind. And I didn't. I was a shoe guy. I like to look at shoes, and he's looking me in the eyes. And he said to me, he shook my hand, and he said a very strange thing to me. He said, "If you keep coming here, you never have to drink again." And I wanted to scream at him, "You don't know me. You don't know me. I drank when I thought drinking would kill my baby. You don't know me." You know, from that day to this one, I've never had to drink again. What's the difference? It certainly wasn't motivation. It certainly wasn't reason. I had less reason to stay sober then. I'd lost everything. What's the difference? The difference is I'm convinced, the difference is the approach that Alcoholics Anonymous offers, and that's just that. That was that firm handshake, and that was a man who looked me in the eye, and a man who reassured me. And I can't tell you how many thousands of times I was reassured that first year that I could stay sober. And that was the whole difference. The difference between my desire and my success was you. What was missing that night in that chapel wasn't God. God was there. What was missing in my life was you. And in order to have you in my life, all I had to do was to recognize that I needed you. And that's the whole difference. And I think that's what the first step is. I think the first step is coming to recognize that left to my own devices, I must drink again. I must drink again. I'll tell you the way I envision it, and I draw pictures in my mind because there's not much else up there. And here's how I picture it. I think of the first step this way. I have alcoholism, and what that means is I must drink. okay? Because that's what alcoholics do. For the last 10,000 years, alcoholics drink again. That's what alcoholics do. They drink again. Now, so there's a drink out ahead of me. And when I was brand new in the program, I don't know if there are any people here who are kind of new, but when I was brand new, I was so close to that drink that I could taste it and smell it. It was just out ahead of me. And they used to say things like, don't drink 5 minutes at a time. And there were times when I sat on my hands for 5 minutes at a time to keep from drinking. But I went to a lot of meetings, and I hung around with a lot of people, and I read the best I could. And gradually, ever so gradually, I began to push that drink out ahead of me. And then, you know, pretty soon it's out there about a week ahead of me. And I start to relax a little bit, and I start to feel a little bit more comfortable. And I go to more meetings, and I start to make coffee, and I do things. And then pretty soon I push the drink out a little bit further and a little bit further. And finally I get it out there so far, I really begin to start to feel comfortable. And then I start saying things like, you know, life's more than just meetings. What you need in your life is balance. Balance is a euphemism for sex, okay? And so I began seeking balance. And you know what happens when you seek balance. You start missing meetings because there isn't a lot of balance in meetings. If there's balance in meetings, they usually have sponsors who tell them to stay away from you. So I began to seek balance, and gradually, or not so gradually, I began to catch up with that drink. Don't forget now, there's a drink out there. It has my name on it, and I'm powerless over it. If I ever catch up to it, I'll drink it because I'm powerless over it. And I began to catch up to that drink. And then things start to happen. They call it a dry drunk, if anybody's never had one, okay? And a dry drunk is when you become an expert and you become judgmental. And I remember I'd sit in meetings. I'd arrive 5 minutes late for a meeting. I'd come in, and somebody would be speaking. And I'd say, well, if I'd known she was speaking, I wouldn't have come. And then I'll spend the next half hour criticizing everything she says, you know? And then I'll bring on the second speaker, and he's worse than the first one. And I know everything he's going to say, and I'm mentally criticizing him, and I'm judging all these stuff. And then they say the Lord's Prayer, and I'm gone, okay? And things get worse and worse, and then pretty soon, I'm my favorite topic again. And what it means is that I'm catching up to my drink. And being powerless means that if I catch up to it, I'll drink it. And I know that's true because I go to a lot of hospitals, and I 12-step a lot of people who have been in the program, and I often ask them, what happened? And they'll usually say, I don't know. And I'll say, I do. What happened was you caught up with your drink, and you're powerless over your drink. I've been around other drinks. You know, on the airplane, I'm around drinks and this and that. And I 12-stepped a guy a few weeks ago, and I poured his booze out. I'm not powerless over. That's his. I'm not powerless over that. I'm powerless over my drink. And over the last 24-plus years, I've had occasion to get pretty close to my drink from time to time. But by the grace of God, I haven't had to pick it up. And so that's what I think being powerless is all about. It means that left to my own devices, I must drink again. And to keep from drinking requires a miracle. And you're the miracle. You're what makes the difference between drinking and not drinking. The same God that was there when I begged for my kid's life was there when I got sober. What wasn't there was you. And I'm glad God worked it out that way. I think I'm one of those people. I have a lot of friends who say, you know, you can go to church and they'll pray over you and you can be struck sober. And I said, I'm sure that's true. God can do whatever he wants to do. The problem is what good would I be? I wouldn't be good to anybody. I mean, what good would my experiences be to others? The beauty of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and doing it this way is that my experience can mean something to another human being. You know, the first step says that you know, it asks this question. It says, why all this insistence that we must first hit bottom? Why all this insistence that we must first hit bottom? And the answer it gives is that unless we've truly hit bottom, we won't do these other things. You know, the 12 steps are not things that you would wake up on a sunny day if you have a tea time and you'll do. You know, the 12 steps are things you only do if you know that not doing them will kill you. Just that simple. I remember Sandy used to say to me, I never wake up and the sun's shining and the birds are singing, and I say, well, what can I do to enhance my spiritual condition today? He said, I always ask that question when there's a gun at my head. And I think that that's true. You know, the first step is an interesting one. The first step is the one that says that as long as I live, I'll remain powerless. When I made that call on May the 13th, 1973, I knew, I still had a bottle of scotch left on the draining board in this kitchen. And I saw it, and I knew that I would drink it. And I had just about, I'd come within a fraction of an inch of committing suicide, and I made this phone call to get help. And I saw that bottle, and I knew I'd drink it. And I ran over to pour it out, and I knew I wouldn't. I began to pour it out, and I knew I wouldn't. And I threw it in the sink and jumped back, and it broke. And I believe if that bottle had bounced, I wouldn't be here. I am that powerless over alcohol. I believe that in that day, I believed that if I took one more drink, I would die. And knowing that would never keep me from taking it. And that's as true today as it was then. I knew I'd never be scared into not drinking. I knew I'd never be frightened into not drinking. I worked at a teaching hospital, and they used to list the things that people died of and they were going to do autopsies on. They would list them, sort of like coming attractions. And if you were interested in any particular illness or something, you could scrub in and watch the autopsy. And from time to time, when I desperately wanted to cut back on my drinking or quit drinking, I would scrub in and watch an autopsy. And they're terrible things to watch. I never enjoyed that. But it was worth it to try to cut back on my drinking. Because after all, I wanted to save my family and things. And believe me, it's a lot easier to go to a meeting. But I'd have the same reaction every time. I'd scrub in, and they'd start this autopsy. And my God, it's awful. And they'd take the brain out, and it's just awful. You know, this guy was like 45 years old, and he died of alcoholism. And his liver looked terrible and all this stuff. And I'd stand it as long as I could, and I'd leave there. And I usually go down to Chadwick's, and I'd run in, and Vinny the bartender would say, what's the matter with you? And I'd say, you'll never guess what I just saw. I'd say, you better give me a double. And he says, you always get a double. I said, you better make it a triple. And he'd get me a triple martini, and I'd sit up there, and my hand would shake. I mean, it was an awful trauma. And then I'd sip it, and everybody at the bar would be waiting, and they'd say, What's the matter? And I'd tell them about this guy. I'd say, you'll never guess. And they'd go, God, that's awful. So they'd order a triple. You know? And then we would spend the next 7 or 8 hours discussing how anybody could do this to themselves. You know, it must be a lot of self-loathing there. Yeah, there probably is a lot of self-loathing there. And that, to me, points out the insanity of alcoholism. And I knew that morning that would never work for me. I knew that I would never, ever, as long as I lived, be able to not drink. And I knew it. And I knew if I took one drink, I'd die, and knowing that would never keep me from taking a drink. This is not a matter of choice, and I know that. This is not a matter of common sense. I showed incredible common sense in most other areas of my life, other than alcohol. When it came to alcohol, I never made good decisions. And I know that. And that'll be true today. If I had to make decisions about alcohol today, it'd be true today. I want to sort of move toward the second step by telling you a story. It's a very sad story. It had a very sad end. But it really points out the power of alcoholism. And it points out the tenaciousness that I think is required to stay sober. I lived in Birmingham, Alabama for a couple years in the early 80s, and the night before I left town, it's probably a good thing that I did it the night before I left town because I was leaving town, but I went to a meeting, and it would break up into a variety of smaller meetings, and I just slid into the nearest one because I was a couple minutes late, and a woman, they had said something and made a mistake of saying, does anybody here have a problem? And a woman said, I have a problem. And she began to discuss a situation she was in. She worked in a convenience store. And she said that her job, she was sober 30 days. And she said her job was to carry cases of beer from the cooler out And she'd take them out individually and put them in a big barrel of ice so you can drink and drive. You know. And she said, "It's making me crazy." She said, "What do I do?" Well, I was sitting to her right. And so the leader said, "Well, that's a good topic. Why don't we go around?" So we went around the circle to the left. There were about 20 of us sitting in this little room. It was interesting to me because about half of the people said to her, "Get away from it. Quit the job. Starve, do anything, but get away from that. It doesn't make sense." And about the other half would quote to her from the book where it says that, you know, that we cease fighting everything, even alcohol, that we live in a life with alcohol, and on and on. So the group was evenly divided about what she should do. So it got to me, and like I say, I was leaving town, so it didn't matter. So I said, "How many people here have slipped?" You know, about half of them had. And you know the half that had were the half that was telling her to go ahead and make a deal with booze. And the half that hadn't slipped were the ones that had tremendous respect for alcohol. And she looked around at the hands and she said, "Oh, I'm going to call them and quit and tell them to send me my check." And I said, "Good for you. Good for you." And that's the power that alcohol holds over us, that those who continue to believe that the day will come when they can exercise power over alcohol. It's an amazing phenomenon to me. I'll give you one more example, and then we'll take a break, and I'll get into the second step in earnest. I was in, a mountainous state, I'll put it that way, and at a conference, and a man hosted me, and he picked me up, and he heard somewhere that I liked to play golf, and he also heard I wasn't very good, and so he took me to he's right on both counts. He took me to his club. He couldn't have been a nicer guy. We met me at the airport, and we had the greatest discussion, and we were laughing, having the best time. And he took me to his club, and two other guys from AA met us, and we played 18 holes of golf, and then we went in and had a nice lunch, and it just couldn't have been nicer, and he was going to take me to the hotel. But on the way, he said, "I'd like you to meet my wife." And I said, "Well, that'd be very nice." So he stopped at his house, and beautiful home, just really exquisite. And he went in, and he showed me around the house and everything, and his wife was sitting in the den. And the minute he walked into the den, he changed. Incredible change came over him. And this happy-go-lucky, jovial guy got very angry. And he said to me, he said, you're probably one of those people who believe in keeping a dry house, huh?" And of course, what he meant was to keep alcohol out of the house. Well, I knew what he meant, but I also knew that I'm experiencing a personality change here. And I said, "Well, yeah, I like to live in a dry house. You know, it keeps down on the mildew and everything." I mean, I was trying to make light of it, but he wasn't hearing it. He said, "There were some fanatics in Alcoholics Anonymous who don't believe I ought to have this bar." And he shook. And I didn't ask, and I wasn't interested. None of my business. But he's going to tell me. And he said, "My wife is sitting over there, and just because I have to quit drinking, there's no reason she has to quit drinking. And if she wants to have a drink, she ought to have a right to have a drink." And his wife said, "As far as I'm concerned, you could get all that shit out of here," which told me everything I needed to know about the family. And there's a lot of people have opinions. And I said, "I personally don't have alcohol in my house, but there's no reason to." I said, "I don't drink." I said, my wife doesn't drink. She's an Al-Anon. She could work the steps and drink. I always envied them, but she doesn't drink. And most of my friends are in AA and on and on. It just doesn't make sense. I said, "I just don't have it in the house." And I'm really trying to make light of all this because this is getting awfully serious. And he said, "I'll never drink again. I'll never drink here. Do you know why?" And I said, "I'd be very interested in hearing that because I read the books and I don't know why." And he said, "I'll show you." And he showed me above his bar. He had glued every one of his chips above the bar. He had the white one and the red one and he glued them above the bar. And he had his 5-year chip up there. And he said, "I have my 5-year chip in my pocket." And he said, "A month from now, I'll get my 6-year chip, and then I'll glue the 5-year chip up there." He said, "If I ever come here to take a drink, all I have to do is look at those chips, and I won't drink." Well, I had all I could stand. And I said, "Pal, when you come here to take a drink, you'll never see those chips." And he threw me out of his house. Threw me out of his house. His wife, to sort of get him, drove me to the hotel, and I had a different host. But it was very unfortunate. It really was very unfortunate. He had was suffering from something my friend Hal M. from Washington, D.C. calls alcoholism. And he was treating it like it was a bad habit and not a disease. And I'm sincere when I say, I believe sincerely and profoundly that what we're dealing with is a disease. And there's nothing short of working these steps and then working with others that will ensure my sobriety. Because I am powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. Why don't we take a break? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I'd like to, before we get rolling, I just ran into a friend of mine, somebody I had met over in a North Miami men's group, who is celebrating 10 years of continuous sobriety today. Jim, where are you? Could you stand up? That's a lot of not drinking 10 years. Second step, came to believe the power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. It's really sort of a fascinating phenomenon, I think, when we look at power. The big book tells us that lack of power is our dilemma. It says that I cannot generate the power to not take a drink. It's really an amazing phenomenon because as a group of people, I suspect that alcoholics are about as self-willed a group of people as I've ever run into in my life. It just amazes me that we can show such willpower in so many areas of our life, and yet when it comes to the drink problem, as the book calls it, we're completely without power. I was one of those people who came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to say I used to think I was an atheist, but I realize now I didn't have the faith to be an atheist. I just did. It takes great faith to be an atheist. I mean, to believe in nothing really takes a lot of effort and energy. And then I thought, well, maybe I was an agnostic. And I think what happened was I got so drunk I just stopped thinking about it. I think that's what happened. I think I was just bacon for a while. Being an agnostic sounded sort of cool because a lot of the losers I were hanging with called themselves agnostics. They were in the same bar as I was in, so they weren't doing any better than I was, I suspect. But I had, and I think I'm sort of glad that I essentially lost my faith before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I think it would have been awfully hard for me to do the things I needed to do in these rooms, to experience what I needed to experience in these rooms, if I could have found even a piece of it anyplace else. I found that the big part of my alcoholism was isolation. And I could remain isolated in church. I could not remain isolated in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because people in AA won't let it happen. They're the obnoxious ones who look you in the eye, remember? And they did strange things to me. I remember I went to a... when I first came to AA, I came through a treatment center. That was the number that my wife gave me in case I needed help when she asked me to leave. And 6 months later, I found that number and I called it. And I went to this treatment center and they took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But one of the things that happened in the treatment center was we talked a lot about feelings. Okay? And I thought feelings must be very important. So I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous and I knew that I didn't belong there. I knew that... that I wasn't an alcoholic, that what I probably was crazy. But I figured that nobody else would have me, so I was going to stick around Alcoholics Anonymous as long as I could. And I went to a meeting with a bunch of old guys, just bad guys, and old-timers. And so I wanted to be liked. So I remember we're talking in a meeting, and so I stood up and shared my feelings. And a great hush came over the meeting. And all these old guys sort of looked at me, and then they went on with the topic. And so I went back a week later, and so they met me at the door, and one man said to me, he said, "You've been sober all week?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "That's great." He said, "We're glad to see you back here." He said, "As a matter of fact," he said, "when you left last week, we had a meeting. So we had a business meeting. And he said, we took a vote." He said, "The vote was 12 to nothing. Nobody gives a shit how you feel." He said, "We're real interested in what you do." He said, "Alcoholics Anonymous is about doing things. You know," he said, "it's about taking actions that don't make sense to you." And he said, "If you don't like the way you feel, wait 5 minutes. You'll feel differently." And I thought, you know, that's exactly right. I really will feel differently. When I knew that there was something happening in these rooms, I kind of knew it right away. But when I began to really experience it, I was, like I said, I was one of these really fear-driven people. I mean, I was fearful of everything, and I didn't know I was afraid. I mean, I was so afraid, I'd been so afraid for so long that I no longer knew it was fear. I mean, I used to go into these outbursts and carry on and curse and do all these things, go crazy, break things. I didn't know that that was all based in fear. I really didn't know that stuff. And I knew that there was no way I could go a day without drinking. And then pretty soon, here I am, I'm going a day without drinking, and then I'm going another day without drinking, I'm going another day without drinking. And I just knew it was a matter of time I'd have to drink. And I recognized that when I was with you, I didn't want to drink. It was the strangest thing. And I looked at the course of my day. My days in the beginning, it was just sort of like controlled madness. It was mad, and it was crazy. And I was always confused. I was so confused. I was sober about 3 months, or I guess about 2 months. And I was going to work. It's a true story. People think this isn't. This is a true story. I was going to work, and I forgot where I worked. I did. I'm all dressed up. I'm looking pretty good. I'm in my car, and I have no earthly idea where to go. And my sponsor had given me his phone number in a card, his home number and his office number, and he taped a dime to it. And he said, "If you ever need me, call me." So I'm terrified now. I can't remember where I work. And so I called my sponsor, but I didn't want him to know that I was just goofy. So I called him up and found a phone booth, and I called him and called his office. I said, "Hey, Dan." He said, "Keith, is that you?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "How are you?" I said, "I'm fine. I was wondering how you are." He said, "I'm all right." He said, "What's all the noise?" I said, "I'm calling you from a phone booth." And he said, "Oh, did your car break down?" I said, "No, car's fine, Dan. Car's fine." And he said, "What's the matter?" "Nothing. I was just wondering how you were." And he said, "What's the problem, Keith?" I said, "Well, it's not much of a problem." I said, I just can't seem to remember where I work. And you know, he said, "Oh, you got the old 'I can't remember where I work' problem, huh?" He said, "A lot of us have had that. And I've been around AA a long time now. I've never met anybody else who forgot where they work." But then he went on to talk to me, and he said, "You know," he said, "you've done a lot of damage to your brain." He said, "You've dumped a lot of alcohol in it, and the book says it's a very unnatural thing to do." And I said, "It sure is." And he said, "You're going to have thinking problems for a while." He said, "For example," he said, "maybe you'll read the book and you won't understand one word." I said, "Well, that happens all the time." And he said, "But we've discovered that if we continue to do what you've been doing, don't drink and go to meetings and call people and talk to people and shake hands," he said, "we've discovered that if we do those things, we get better." Now, why on earth would I believe that? But I did. I did. And before he hung up, he said to me, "May I make a suggestion?" I said, "Well, anything. I'm willing, honest, open-minded." And he said, "Let me suggest, if you ever have this problem again, try to remember to look at the bumper of your car, because you have a parking sticker for the university." And I remember thinking, where do these people learn these things? Most amazing thing. I mean, they're so wise. They have such wisdom. And I thought about that. And I thought about the days when I would leave the hospital and I would be frantic. And I didn't know what I was frantic about. I was just frantic. And my normal course of action was I'd have a calendar and an AA schedule. And then I would go to where the meeting was going to be. The meeting was at 8:30, and I'd go there at 5:30, where the meeting was going to be, to make sure I knew how to get there. And then I would decide whether or not I would come back. And if I thought there was a chance I wouldn't come back, I would wait across the street from the meeting for 3 hours. Because I thought, if I go home, I may not leave, and I may not come back. And if I don't come back, I'm going to die. And I'd wait across the street. And I remember sitting in the car, and I'd watch these AA people begin to assemble. And I remember how happy I would be just seeing them. And they would meet outside the church, and they'd be shaking hands and hugging each other and patting each other on the back and doing all this stuff. And I remember just watching that sort of fellowship and camaraderie, how much it meant to me. How, even though I couldn't take part in it, it made my day. And then at about 8:25, I would get out of the car, and I'd go across the street and shake a few hands or something and get in there. And then I'd listen during the meeting. And then at the end of the meeting, they did this strange thing. They prayed. They'd say the Lord's Prayer. And they didn't hold hands then. That's sort of new. That they were probably just starting that on the West Coast, because everything starts on the West Coast and moves this way. You know what Ray O'Kay says about the West Coast? He says that the country's tilted, and everything that's loose rolls to the West Coast. But we stood up and we said the Lord's Prayer, and I made an amazing discovery. The discovery was that the best I felt all day was after I said amen at the end of the Lord's Prayer. It's an amazing phenomenon to me. And I didn't understand it then, but I began to realize that there was a power working in my life that I didn't understand. It was definitely outside of me, that was taking an insane life and making it work. And the set of circumstances that took place in my life were phenomenal when I look back now. And I knew what was happening was there was a power that was greater than I was. It was altering the course of my life. It was doing it in very, very subtle ways. The whole proposition for the second step is an evolutionary one. It says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves restores to sanity. You always hear these long discussions about what sanity is, you know, and insane and that sort of thing. I love the definition that says sanity is the presence of peace of mind, and insanity is the absence of peace of mind. And only people who have been completely without peace can know the value of peace. I'm married to a woman that I love very much, and we live in a home that is just filled with peace. People come to visit us, and they just say, this place is so peaceful. There's a lady who comes to clean the house. And I'll come in, and she comes every other Wednesday, and I'll come in or something like that. And she'll just be sitting back in the chapel having a cup of tea. We have a little room we've designated as a chapel, and here Fifth Steps, and I read and pray and meditate in there. And she'll just be sitting there, and she'll say, I hope you don't mind. I just didn't want to leave. And the amazing thing is that, you know, people live in that house. An insane drunk and an insane pre-Al-Anon live in that house. And there's this tremendous peace in there. You know, I grew up in a family with the firm belief that if you're wrong, you have to get off the planet. You have to be right. I mean, the most important thing in the world is being right. My first wife and I would have these awful arguments, and they'd go on and on and on and on, and I'd even have to change it to be right. I mean, I'd change the question so I'd have the right answer. And it was just being right was the most important thing in the world, because being right is what mattered. And I don't know who's right. Doesn't matter. Just doesn't matter. I'm married to a woman now that I've only had two arguments with. I've known her 14 years. We knew each other about 30 days. We had an argument. She called up my sponsor to second-guess one of his suggestions. That'll cause an argument. And the next one, we were married about 6 months. And we had an argument. Started, and it was in the kitchen. I remember. I don't even remember what it was about, But I started to raise my voice, and she started to raise her voice. And I just stopped. There were about 5 seconds. I stopped. I said, I love you more than anything in the world. I'm arguing with you. This is crazy. What could be that important? And I said, I think I'll go call my sponsor and find out what's wrong with me, what my problem is. Because that's what the 10th step tells me, isn't it? The problem's with me. And she said, I think I'll call my sponsor and ask her what my problem is. This is the last time we've bothered to argue. And what's amazing about that is I was a guy who lived in constant conflict I was angry at and about everything. There was no peace in my mind about anything. If I happened, you know, to have a moment or two alone, I would think about what it is I was upset about. And like I had a list of them. And if something got resolved, I'd have to go to the next thing, because what mattered was that I stay on this edge of excitement, this edge of opinion that kept me going. I sort of ran on the adrenaline that came from this sort of excitement. Remember the first time I experienced peace, I thought I was fainting. I mean, that's the way it was on the inside, and it was like that all the time. The second step tells me that something will happen in my life gradually that'll make sure that I experience great peace. I used to have a lot of strange ideas, a lot of old ideas about how AA worked. And one of the things I thought, I don't know whether I got this from treatment or what, I don't know, but one of the ideas I had was that you run into a problem and you have to get an answer for that problem, and you only have so much time to get an answer. And if you don't get an answer, a big hand comes down and puts a drink in your mouth. Okay? And sort of like once you recognize the problem, the clock begins to run. And I'd recognize this problem, and I'd always go to old timers. I tell you, if you're kind of new, stay away from old timers. Okay? Old timers are not nice people. They really aren't. I'll give you an example, okay? They say things like, I go to meetings because I need to. That's a lie. They don't need to go to meetings. The only reason they go to meetings is to watch people like you and me suffer. It's true. And if you don't believe me, go to find an old timer and tell them a problem. The first thing they do when you tell them a problem is laugh, isn't it? I remember when I first got sober, I was impotent, which will put a real crimp in your sex life if you hadn't noticed. And I made the mistake of going to an old timer and telling him about it. Oh, he loved that one. Oh, that's the most fun he'd had in days. And he said, oh, it'll get better. I said, when? He said, what, do you got a full social calendar? Well, I went to this old fool, and I told him, I can't remember what the problem was, but it was a big problem in June of 73. I don't know if you were around, but a big problem in June of 73. And I went to him, and I thought he had to give me an answer, and then I'd be all right. And he said to me, he said, Keith, I don't know the answer to that. And I said, oh, no. And he said, but there's a man down at the Metropolis Club in downtown D.C. He said, his name's Amos. He knows the answer to that, I'm sure. So I got my car, and I rushed down. I got about 45 minutes to live. And I rushed down to the club, and I go in and ask for Amos. And Amos is out on a 12-step call. And I said, this is really urgent. When will we be back? And the lady said, he'll be back soon for a meeting. So Amos came in dragging a trunk with him. And I ran over. I said, I got to talk to you. And he said, well, we're going to have our meeting now. I said, I don't know if I'll be alive at the end of this meeting. He said, you sit next to me. People sitting next to me never died. So I sat right next to Amos. And the meeting was over, and I told Amos my problem. And I said, I was told that you could give me an answer. And Amos looked at me. He's a beautiful man. He's a black man and had white eyebrows. I'll never forget. And the kindest eyes I've ever seen. He looked at me very kindly. He said, son, he said, I don't know the answer to that. And I said, oh, no. And he said, but, he said, I have a suggestion. I said, anything. He said, don't drink even if your ass falls off. And I remember driving home thinking, that's the most profound thing I ever heard in my life. I mean, what a concept. Don't drink. And I found that that's the solution. Alcoholics Anonymous isn't about answers. It's about solution. And what the second step does is it teaches me that. The second step teaches me that recovery, sobriety, is a process that happens based upon experiences. And it's an amazing thing. You know, they talk about the time coming when all alcoholics must pick up a drink. I was sober 3 or 4 months, and I was overwhelmed with guilt. I had a couple little girls that I wasn't permitted to see. I wasn't permitted in the state in which they lived. I mean, it was really bad. It's just a mess. I was deeply in debt, just everything in the world. And I was one of those people who had just become overwhelmed with guilt. I had a buddy dear friend of mine, Mike W., who I went to. I hadn't known Mike long, and I went to him, and I asked him, I said, do you know anything about guilt? He said, do I? He said, let me tell you. He said, when I was about 3 years old, he said, my mother read to me from a book. And at the end of the book, it said, who killed Cock Robin? And Mike said, I thought, I don't know, but I probably did. Now, that's the kind of guilt I had. And I was getting ready to leave. It's a place we used to go after the meeting to have ice cream and things. And I was going to leave. Now, I can't tell you I was going to go drink. I didn't know what I was going to do. What I do know is that I was deep, deep, deep despair. And I was leaving, and a man named Happy Harold, if you're ever in Washington, D.C., please look up Happy Harold. But Happy Harold had led our meeting, and he saw me leaving. And there's something about people who have some time in Alcoholics Anonymous. They can spot us when we're in trouble. And he said to me, he said, I don't know you. He said, but I'd like to. He said, you've got a few minutes. And I'm thinking, well, if you're going to go die, there's no hurry. So I sat down, and he began to talk to me, and he said to me, he said, what's the problem? You have a problem, don't you? And I said, you know, I just feel so guilty. I began to tell him about these two little girls and on and on. And I said, I don't know how it'll ever be any better. And he said, well, let me tell you. And he told me this story. He said that his mother was dying. She was in intensive care, and she called all her children. She had five children. And she called them all and said, would you come and see me tomorrow morning? And she said to Harold, Harold, I want you to come, but don't be drinking. I don't want to die having seen my oldest boy drunk. And so he said, the next morning, he said, I went to the hospital, and he said, I was drunk. And I said, you were? He said, of course I was. I was an alcoholic. He said, and they wouldn't let me go up and see her, so I called her up in the intensive care unit and said, Mama, can I come and see you? And she said, are you drinking, Harold? And he said, yeah. And she said, then I don't want to see you. And he said, well, my brothers and sisters were saying goodbye to my mom. I was downstairs, and she died. And I said, Harold, how do you live with that? And he said, you'll discover that your biggest guilt becomes your greatest gift. And I was so overwhelmed. I was so overwhelmed by the certainty this man had that I forgot to die, and I just went on with my life. And it must have been about 3 months later I saw Harold over at in the hospital where I worked. And he was by the elevator, and I ran over and shook his hand and everything, and we talked for a few minutes, and he got on the elevator and he left. I just assumed he was there on a 12-step call. And the nurse came up to me and said, do you know Mr. B? And I said, oh, you mean Happy Harold? I said, yeah, I know him well. And she said, he's the finest man I know. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I said, you know, whenever we have an old person over here who's dying and has no one, we call Harold. He comes and helps him die. And I could hear his words. Your biggest guilt becomes the greatest gift. And I began to understand something about the spiritual nature of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think a big part of the second step is the recognition that the worst I've done, the worst things I've done become my greatest gifts. In the idea, the very idea that I can overcome these horrible things, not that they're forgotten, not only that somehow I can make up for them, but even more importantly, they become the very thing that makes me function and keeps me going. My sponsor is a man named Tom I. Tom I got sober in Jackson State Prison in Michigan. Right now, Tom I is the second or third leading guy in the Department of Correction in the state of North Carolina. You know, directly as a result of his efforts and his tenaciousness, we treat 1,000 men and women a month who have alcoholism and drug problems in the state of North Carolina as a result of what this man did. He ran two kids down in a blackout, killed them. The second step promises me that God will take whatever I've done and turn it into pure gold. It's better than being forgiven. I just wanted to be forgiven. It's better than being forgiven. And Alcoholics Anonymous has a way of making us realize that the more we do, the longer we're around, the further in debt we are.
And right now, in just a short period of time I've been in AA, I'm hopelessly in debt to you people. I'll never be able to pay you back for what you've done. And all you ever ask me to do is to do the kind of inventory work I need to do so that I will know which gifts it is I'm being prepared to use. Second step says that there's a process that takes place that makes us recognize that something outside of us can turn us into something we never dreamed of being. You know, when I look at my life prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was a kid who I never ever wanted to do most of the things I did. It was never my intention to hurt the people I hurt and all of that. It was never my intention. And yet, I can look back at my life, and every year that I drank, I could say one thing, and that is at the end of each year, I could say I'm less the person I wanted to be than I was this time last year. I violated more principles, I violated more values, I hurt more people I loved, and every year it was worse and worse and worse. And then I found a bunch of people in a basement of a church who smoked too much and drank too much coffee and laughed all the damn time, particularly at my problem. And just meeting you and just being with you, every year, I'm more the person I want to be than I've ever been the year before. And that's the second step. I have great promise in Alcoholics Anonymous. The great promise is that one day I'll be the man I really want to be. It happens gradually, it happens slowly, just like I got sick. And to believe that the power of greater in ourselves can restore us to sanity. You know, the third step. Maybe he doesn't want me talking about the third step. You know, the only logical outcome, or the only logical response to the second step is the third step. That is, made a decision to turn our world and lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. You know, my second sponsor, Sandy, was a guy who just sort of kept things simple for me. I got involved theologically. When I got sober, I was granted a scholarship, and I went to school, and I took a degree in philosophy and a degree in theology and all that. I really took a degree in theology to just in case. It was a lot like with, W.C. Fields was a pretty well-known atheist, and he was dying in a hospital in Philadelphia, and some friends came in, and they caught him reading the Bible, which was very embarrassing to him, and he tried to hide it, and they caught him, and they said, we caught you reading the Bible. Have you changed your mind about God? And he said, no, I was just looking for loopholes. And I think that my desire to study theology was largely that. It occurred to me that a lot of you people talk an awful lot about God, and I personally wanted to avoid that subject. You'll see a lot of us around the meetings that, you know, the people who are religiously anti-religious, you know, they make a religion out of keeping God out of meetings. Well, I was one of those people. And, of course, it's because I was frightened of God. But I went to see another old-timer. You think I'd learned my lesson somewhere along the line. But I went to see another old-timer and talked to him about the third step. And he spent a lot of time talking to me about our concept of God and it's God as we understand Him. And he went on and on. And he said, but you really need to talk to your sponsor about this. So I went back to Sandy, and I talked to him. I said, I'm not sure whether or not I believe in God, and I'm not sure whether or not I can turn my will and life over to the care of God. And he said, well, that's all right. He said, you're a special case. He said, we're going to turn your will and life over to anything that will take it. He said, your will and life would be better off in the hands of a baboon than your hands. And he said, I want you to do something for me. I said, what? He said, I want you to go home. And he said, I want you to spend some time now. He said, turn off the TV and everything. He said, I want you to sit quietly. And he said, I want you to think of your worst enemy. Who's your worst enemy? I said, well, it's either my ex-wife or her lawyer. He said, okay. He said, and I want you to think of what would your ex-wife or her lawyer do to you? Would they do to you what you've done to you? You know, I thought about it, and the answer is no. I mean, they might do it for a week. Then they get bored and go on with their own lives. I punish me day in and day out. So it occurred to me that it makes fine sense. You know, maybe the last thing in the world I do want to do is to run my own life. Maybe if I could get anything to take my life, my will and my life, it would be better than what I've got going now. And so that's what I did. I got on my knees and I prayed that third step prayer, which we know is on page 63 in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got in the presence of another human being. I got on my knees and I prayed that prayer. And I'd like to tell you that something mysterious happened to me, and it really didn't. I got up from there. I didn't feel any differently than when I got down on my knees. But things began to happen in my life, which tells me that the third step really and truly took place. I began to recognize and notice things. I understood that part in the book. He had me read the third step in the 12 and 12 every day for 30 days. He said, I want you to read this every day for 30 days. He said, at the end of 30 days, you get a reward. And I said, well, what's the reward? He said, well, I'm not going to tell you. It's a surprise. He said, now read it every day. So I read it every day. I read about it. I thought about made me crazy, you know, about the iron lung. When's the last time anybody here saw an iron lung? You know, you're reading about the iron lung, and then about electricity and that magical force and on. And it's making me crazy, but I read it. You can read it in 8 minutes and 23 seconds. That's how long it takes to read the third step. I read it every day for 30 days. And I went to him, and I said, I've done it, Sandy. I read the third step every day for 30 days. What's my reward? And he said, if you've truly made a decision to turn your will and life over to the care of God as you understand him, your reward is that your will and your life is no longer in the hands of an idiot. That's your reward. I didn't think it was amusing, but he got a kick out of it. But you know, the things began to happen which indicated to me that it was true, that truly my will and my life was beginning to change. And the first thing that happened to me was I remember we were having a discussion, and I said to somebody, oh, I don't have an opinion on that. And everybody stopped. You could hear a pin drop. This friend of mine said, Keith, you have an opinion on everything. And I said, I know I do. This is amazing. But I don't have an opinion on that. And he said, you must. I said, I'll try to come up with one, but I swear to you, I don't have an opinion on this. And it was just this a truly amazing and liberating experience to not have an opinion on something. Had something to do with the Middle Eastern. I don't know what it was, but I just didn't have an opinion. Book tells me that that my problems are self-centered fear. I'm either afraid I'm going to lose something I have or not get something that I need. I was one of those folks who grew up in great poverty. There were a bunch of us. I had 10 brothers and sisters, and there were a bunch of us, and if you found me drinking, I would have told you that that my problem was that I grew up in poverty, and I'd have you just in tears. You know, the truth of the matter was is that we didn't have any material things, but neither did a lot of other people.